You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Jennifer Egan's latest novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, is structured as a series of interconnected stories told from different points of view. It moves from one character to the next and from one place to the next, from 1970s San Francisco to Naples, Italy, Africa, and to the present and future New York. It touches on the passing of time, memory, mistakes and regret, music, and how technology changes our lives. It's her fourth novel, and it's published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that it brings Jennifer Egan back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Haven't some of the chapters been published already in The New Yorker?
Yes, three of them were published in The New Yorker, a couple of them just since the new year.
Did you write them as standalones?
Well, I wanted each piece to stand alone. I had a few ground rules about the book, one of which was that each piece had to be about someone different, and yet they all would have to combine into one story. Each piece would have to stand alone, and most important, each piece would have to be completely different from all the others in terms of tone and world and feeling.
So in an odd way, that made it easier to find different voices for the different characters, because if you're writing a novel and you're changing voices in alternating chapters or here and there, sometimes it can be rather confusing, can it?
Exactly. I felt like I wanted more range. I wanted to range from farce to tragedy in one book, and I couldn't see really how to do that in a traditional novel. So I thought, let's break it apart and put it back together and see if I can get away with more that way.
But then there's also the whole matter of telling a large story in a novel allows you to do that. It allows you to digress in short stories. Everything has to be compressed. So was the large story always there in the back of your head?
I think it must have been there somewhere. I was unaware of it. I wrote this book very inductively. I started with the first piece in there, Found Objects, which is about a woman who ends up stealing a wallet from a bathroom and what happens to her after that. And I thought that would just be it. But then I was sort of intrigued by a mention of her boss, who we learn sprays pesticide in his armpits and sprinkles gold flakes into his coffee. And I intended that as just sort of a laugh line. But I found myself thinking later, why would someone do those things? So then I started writing a story about him. And then there was a mention of his ex-wife in that story. And she intrigued me and seemed a little cliched in the way I had mentioned her. But I thought, well, no one is a cliche. Who is this lady? And I explored her in a different piece.
So in an odd way, the novel, as I said, allows you to digress. You were allowing yourself to digress with different stories each time.
I think the digression was really the organizing principle of this book, actually, which, again, I think would be quite hard in a traditional novel. I love the idea of it being polyphonic and having characters be both central and peripheral at the same time at different moments.
And there are a couple of central characters. There is Benny Salazar, a music executive, and his assistant, Sasha, and has a lot to do with music. Is that something that you'd been interested in, or did you have to do a lot of research for that?
I did some research, yes. I mean, there's a chapter that takes place in the punk rock scene in San Francisco in the late 70s, which I have to confess I knew firsthand, although not as a punk, just kind of as an observer. But in terms of the actual technology of recording, analog versus digital, some of that stuff I did have to research. But in a way, my interest in music was as much as anything the way music lodges in our minds and captures a certain moment of our youths and stays with us in a way that makes time seem to disappear when we hear those songs again.
And there, for some people, they never get past the music of a certain era in their lives. Others do want to keep on changing. But I know people who will only listen to the music that they grew up with.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is, well, that's the cliche.
It defines music. Who they are in their heads.
And they think music has gone downhill since then, surprisingly.
The stories are really akin to snapshots of different people's lives over a wide span of time. High school, college, the present day, even the future. And what about the future? Isn't that usually the province of science fiction?
You know, I couldn't resist reaching into it. I didn't really plan to, but I found myself doing it, and I just kind of went with it. And in a way, it makes sense because the book is so much about time and really, to a large degree, inspired by Proust, you know, reading his opus in my 40s as opposed to my 20s when in some sense it didn't mean that much to me. But I found myself wanting to look at to write a book about time in our era, which also seemed to be to require writing a book about technology, and that seemed to require at least taking a gander at the future.
So you can do extensions of the iPhone and what those technologies suggest, and it's not so hard to go to some future ideas.
Well, I tried to keep it pretty generic because I'm not in the business of inventing products. And, you know, that's a quick way to look like you got it wrong. But I tried to extrapolate from the present. And I say this as a non-iPhone user, actually someone who only does email on a laptop. But I just tried to just imagine where we would be a few steps ahead of where we are now technologically.
It is always a problem for writers. 1984 turned out to be a little different than Orwell imagined it. 2001, that computer was immense on the space station. In 2001, it would have been probably a couple of chips.
Exactly.
HAL would have been teeny instead of huge.
Exactly. You have to be very careful. But I do make some slightly scary projections about the age at which people might begin using handsets. There's something called a starfish, and preverbal children can download songs as long as they're old enough or, you know, on top of things enough to point. So that was something I did think about, and I found myself thinking, you know, that might actually happen.
Well, is this the sort of thing that you also would be connected to your nonfiction writing?
I think often I end up exploring some ideas in my nonfiction before I get to them in fiction. I mean, I did a piece about online dating some years ago, and I've been married a long time, so I didn't know really much of anything about online dating. And that was actually fascinating to me, to find out how people were connecting in that way. And in fact, the protagonist who steals the wallet is on a date with someone that she's meeting for the first time after online correspondence in chapter one. And we revisit that guy, her date, many, many years later in a chapter from his point of view. And I think there was a little bit of the DNA of my subjects in that online dating story in my characters.
Well, maybe not online dating, but what about Facebook and things like that? Are you one of those people who joins Facebook after everybody else has, or are you one of the first adopters?
I'm very much at the end with technology. I write by hand. I think that kind of says it all. I write fiction on legal pads, and I use a computer as a typing machine. So I did finally join Facebook, but I'm, you know, rather friendless, in quotes, by Facebook terms. So I'm pretty late, but I guess as an imaginative exercise, I like to project out. But in terms of my real life, I'm pretty sluggish about adopting technology.
My guest is Jennifer Egan, whose latest book is a series of interconnected stories that form a novel called A Visit from the Goon Squad. It's published by Knopf. You mentioned Proust. Well, at the center of Remembrance of Things Past, or whatever the new title of it is Marcel. But there's no Jennifer here.
There's never a Jennifer there. Or actually, she's hiding behind a bush. I really don't like to write about my own life. Of course, I have no choice because I'm always extrapolating from that. But I like to hide that fact from myself. And that's what keeps it interesting for me. So I feel most comfortable writing about people who are nothing like me, which I think is one reason I really like writing from a male point of view.
It also that's can lead to all these different short stories with different characters. It's almost like being an actor.
Well, it's true. I feel like what's off limits is a life just like mine. But what I get, which I think, and I think this is a good deal for me, is get to do almost anything else. So I think it's a fair trade.
Where did the idea come from to write a story in PowerPoint?
Well, I know exactly when that idea came along. I was reading about the campaign in 2008 and about the turnaround of the Obama campaign. And it was mentioned in the Times that the seminal document of that turnaround had been a PowerPoint presentation, and it was branded right in the paper, which I found strange. Usually you would think about a memo or a paper or something, presentation. So I thought, okay, this has become generic. And then that led me to wonder if I could use that genre to write fiction. Although, as I said, I'm a late adopter, so I had never used PowerPoint, did not own it, didn't have enough memory on my laptop to hold it. So there were a few steps there that were required before I became conversant in PowerPoint. But it ended up being a lot of fun.
So you didn't write that one in longhand?
I actually did try. I'm sort of ashamed to say it. I tried writing a PowerPoint story in longhand on a legal pad because I was too cheap to buy PowerPoint. But I realized that wasn't going to work. And I actually did a lot of reading. cheating in the genre, if you will, which basically meant, you know, contacting all my friends in corporate America and asking them to send me their PowerPoints, which I devoured with fascination and, you know, took notes of charts I especially liked and actually lifted one chart straight out of someone else's presentation. I just loved the graphic. So, but it was a challenge because what I realized is that PowerPoint is about taking apart a moment of fiction and diagramming the structure of that moment. And that's something that you can't really do in conventional fiction. So that was exciting.
And you tell the story from, it's written by a 12-year-old girl. I'm not sure whether it's meant to be set in the future because PowerPoint is with us now.
Yes, that was a funny thing. I thought, oh, I have a great idea. It'll be written by a kid because in the future, kids will use PowerPoint. But then I learned they're already using it. It does take place in the future, though. It's out in the desert, and we learn that there are no more lawns. There are no more golf courses. They visit a ruin of a golf course. The desert animals have taken over all of the lawns, and there are just miles and miles and miles of solar panels.
She observes her parents and her brother in the story and goes into detail about pauses in rock and roll, something her brother's obsessed with. What got you interested in pause? Are we talking about those false endings that you get in songs sometimes?
Yes, just a silence in the middle of a song before the music resumes. I first thought about such a thing in reading about the band Semisonic, a book by Jacob Schlichter, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name, called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. And he mentions that there's a Closing Time, which is Semisonic's huge hit, has this pause in it. And there was a lot of discussion around that pause. In fact, there was a producer who was actually known for putting pauses into songs. I didn't realize how much that idea had lodged in my brain, but I found myself trying to revisit it in the book. At one point, I had an academic in there in one of the failed pieces, and her book was about pauses in rock and roll songs. And then somehow that idea floated toward the PowerPoint idea, and it was a very good match because PowerPoint is all about pauses, of course.
You picked out something to read for us. Is it PowerPoint or something else?
It's not PowerPoint, although I should mention I have a color version of the PowerPoint as a slideshow with sound. You can hear the pauses and a little music around them on my website, jennifregan.com, which I think is pretty cool. I'm just going to read from the very beginning of the book. This piece is called Found Objects. It began the usual way in the bathroom of the L'Asimo Hotel. Sasha was adjusting her yellow eyeshadow in the mirror when she noticed a bag on the floor beside the sink that must have belonged to the woman whose peeing she could faintly hear through the vault-like door of a toilet stall. Inside the rim of the bag, barely visible, was a wallet made of pale green leather. It was easy for Sasha to recognize, looking back, that the peeing woman's blind trust had provoked her. We live in a city where people will steal the hair off your head if you give them half a chance, but you leave your stuff lying in plain sight and expect it to be waiting for you when you come back? It made her want to teach the woman a lesson. But this wish only camouflaged the deeper feeling Sasha always had, that fat, tender wallet offering itself to her hand. It seemed so dull, so life as usual, to just leave it there rather than seize the moment, accept the challenge, take the leap, fly the coop, throw caution to the wind, live dangerously. I get it, Cause, her therapist said, and take the damn thing. You mean steal it. He was trying to get Sasha to use that word, which was harder to avoid in the case of a wallet than with a lot of the things she'd lifted over the past year when her condition, as Cause referred to it, had begun to accelerate. 5 sets of keys, 14 pairs of sunglasses, a child's striped scarf, binoculars, a cheese grater, a pocket knife, 28 bars of soap, and 85 pens, ranging from cheap ballpoints she'd used to sign debit card slips to the Aubergine Visconti that cost $260 online, which she'd lifted from her former boss's lawyer during a contracts meeting. Sasha no longer took anything from stores. Their cold, inert goods didn't tempt her, only from people. Okay, she said, steal it.
Now, Sasha is like a number of these characters, somebody who's a rebellious teenager who's having a difficult time adjusting to aging and adulthood. And that does seem to be ultimately what this book is about. The legacy of decisions we made when we were young. It's kind of like the person who has a tattoo when he's 15 years old and then finds himself at 55 with this tattoo and no real reason to have it.
Well, in the last chapter, which takes place in the future, we learn that no one gets tattoos anymore because they look so lousy on so many generations of people who have aged. You know, it's funny. That's the one aspect of the book that I didn't really think about that was a little inadvertent. The question of, you know, impulsive or youthful decisions playing out in negative ways. I worry that that could be seen from a moralistic standpoint. It's certainly not intended. I think what interested me more is the way that time is so invisible. It passes so subtly, and yet we notice it in these quantum moments. So there's this sense in which we make decisions and they play out, and then in a moment it will be clear whether that decision was right or wrong. That contrast or that tension really interested me.
Just one more thing. Where does the title A Visit from the Goon Squad come from?
It came out of thin air. I knew the title before I had any idea what the book would be about. And one of the questions I had was who the goon would turn out to be. We do learn who that is when a character says, time's a goon. Isn't that the expression? Which I thought was actually kind of a cool expression. It just sort of came to me in a moment.
And the next work is going to be nonfiction again, or are we going to see some more fiction from it?
More fiction set in New York in the late 40s. I'm curious about women who worked in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So something really different.
Jennifer Egan's latest book is A Visit from the Goon Squad. It's published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure. Thank you. We'll be right back.